Hank Marvin, I cannot tell you just how thrilled I am to be talking to you. You are a living legend, and I've been a fan since you started recording all those years ago as The Drifters, and then The Shadows, and as Hank Marvin, so it's just great to catch up.
Thanks really for those kind words. You're clearly a very gullible person.
Well, I tell you this, we may as well talk a memory. The first time I met you, it was when you came to Dunedin in 1961 with Cliff Richard, and you just may recall the landing at the airport here. It was rather eventful and rather bumpy, and I know Cliff was terrified to the point that he didn't want to fly out the next day after the show. He thought he'd go by car, rowboat, anything at all. He just didn't like the landing. And I know that Bruce Welsh remembers it, but it was...
They were, if I remember right, Neil, they were the days of the DC-3s, weren't they?
Absolutely. A DC-3
it was. Twin engine, yeah, grass runways and all that stuff. Yeah, it was quite an adventure, really. But we over the years, we've had a few of those very unfortunate and stomach-churning landings in different countries. But hey, I guess when you do a lot of flying, you know, you're bound to hit quite a few of those, yeah.
Well, obviously.
But anyway, we survived, I'm glad to say.
You've been back several times since, and your last trip to New Zealand was the 50th anniversary trip with Cliff Richard. Is it all over now with The Shadows, Hank?
Yes, well, we did our... Well, we actually broke up at the end of 1990, and then I pursued... the record company offered me a 6-album deal, which I thought was great, so I was able to do something a little bit different, still obviously using my own sound and, you know, continuing in doing something a little bit different, which all proved to be very successful. But then we decided to do, as we'd never done a final tour with The Shadows, it just kind of stopped, you know, we just decided to stop because of problems within the band. And it happened, 1990 happened to be a great year for us. We had a platinum album and two big tours in Europe and the UK, but it all came to a grinding halt. So the idea of doing a final tour of The Shadows came up, and we did that. We did a big tour of the UK, then went through Europe, and we were asked to come to Australia, New Zealand, and Asia, but we kind of done enough by then. We thought, oh, you know, it's like another sort of 3 months now, we're going to back off now, so we didn't do it. I regret that in a way. I'd like to have come over here with The Shadows at that point and sort of said, you know, goodbye to everybody, but we didn't. But fortunately, we were able to do that with the tour you mentioned, the Cliff and The Shadows final reunion tour, and that was a great experience for all of us, you know,
yes,
because
indeed.
Obviously so much nostalgia involved, Neil, with playing all those. Well, I mean, the show basically consisted of Cliff and The Shadows recordings from, say, 1958 right through to 65, and plus, obviously, you know, Shadows numbers too. And it was great revisiting those old numbers that we hadn't played for years. You know, it was brilliant.
And really, Hank, a wonderful, magical 50 years or so to look back on. Quite a career, really, isn't it?
Yes, it's something that none of us expected, of course, in the early days, Neil. You know, we the thought of a hit record was kind of a fantasy almost. And then you get one hit record, whether it be with Cliff or whether it be with ourselves, with Apache initially, and then, oh, maybe we might get another one. You never know. What if we got three hit records? Which was the only people who seemed to get more than one hit record were people like Elvis Presley, Buddy Holly and the Everly Brothers. Everyone else seemed to be one-hit wonders, or maybe two, you know. So we probably didn't even dare to dream that we'd have a string of hits and be able to continue as long as we did and have such a great great time. A fantasy world in those days, even to think about those things.
When you go right back to the start, you and Bruce Welsh, you did it pretty tough once you left school there in Newcastle and you headed off for London's Tin Pan Alley, places like that. You nearly starved to death at one stage.
Well, that's why I'm so thin, Neil. I've never got over it. Bruce and I came to London in April 1958, and we managed to find a bed sit in the north of London, and we were able just to, you know, hop on a train to get into the West End. And we played in a little coffee bar, which was quite famous then, called the Two Eyes Coffee Bar. It was a very tiny coffee bar upstairs with a cellar below which wasn't really that big. I've been back since. I went back about 10 years ago, part of a documentary, and I was looking, I couldn't believe how small it was. Some people have got bigger, you know, living rooms. And they used to cram people in there with a little stage at one end, and that's where we played sometimes 5-6 nights a week, and which just made enough money to pay the rent and be able to eat and get trained for and so forth. But yes, sadly, at times, we didn't have any money, and we used to, if we didn't have a gig at the Two Eyes, we used to stay in bed to conserve energy, because we honestly didn't have anything to eat for sometimes up to 2 days, and it was pretty hard. But I think when you're 16 years old, as we were, you have a different perspective on life. These things are almost an adventure. You know, you don't expect too much when you're 16. Mm-hmm. Particularly in those days, it was a different sort of society. Very few people had cars, for example. There were no mobile phones, obviously. Very few people had a phone in their home, only wealthy people. You know, so I think the expectations of us as young people were not very high. We just wanted to play music. So if you didn't eat for 2 days, well, tough. You know, you just kind of gone on with it. And when you got some, I'll tell you one good thing about it, though, Neil, it cured me of my distaste for vegetables other than peas and carrots. we earned some money doing a gig, and Bruce and I went to a working man's cafe near where we used to live.
Yes.
And we went there for half a crown, that's 2 and 6 in the old money. You got a 3-course meal. It was a bowl of soup, meat, and 3 veg, or 2 veg, I suppose, and a dessert. And, of course, the meat came with cabbage and Brussels sprouts, which I hated. But I'll tell you what, I was so hungry, not having eaten for nearly 2 days, I just ate everything on the plate. And from that point on, I would eat anything. I would try anything. It was probably very good for me.
Luxury. Remember that?
Sheer luxury.
Remember that Monty Python sketch? Eventually you saw the world, Hank.
Yes, and that's been a wonderful experience and a privilege, really, to be able to travel around the world, see places I only remember from school in geography, and to be paid to do it. Brilliant, you know, and that's something we really enjoyed, seeing different styles of architecture, for example, in parts of Europe or Asia or wherever, different cultures, different foods. Absolutely brilliant, you know, to be able to do all that. Something, as I say, like Hit Records, that we probably didn't even dream much about. You know, it seems so remote. And you know, one of the annoying things, Neil, was when I was at school learning French, I thought, what's the point? I'm never going to get to France, because in those days, there were no things like package holidays. The only people who traveled into Europe, people with money. I came from a working class background. I thought, there's no way that people like me are going to go to France. It's just too expensive. And I wasn't that interested. And of course, the ironic thing was that as soon as we started having Hit Records, particularly the Shads, we became enormous in France. And we were going there all the time doing shows. And I so regretted not having paid more attention to my French teacher. But there you go.
Two things happened to you way back then. One, of course, was seeing Buddy Holly perform, or looking at a record cover of the Chirping Crickets, I think.
That's right. It was the record cover,
with
yes.
Buddy Harmon and those guys. And you thought, that guitar that he's playing, that Stratocaster, is that how it's pronounced?
Stratocaster.
The Fender. And you thought to yourself, I want to be like him, or I want to play that guitar. It was something like that. And eventually, you certainly did. In fact, you had the first Stratocaster in the UK, as I understand it. That's one major thing that happened in your life.
The thing was, the music that Buddy and the Crickets played was very appealing at the time, hence the success they had. And there was a lot of affection for him, and still is in the UK. I mean, people of my generation, like the Beatles and the Stones, people like that, you know, we're not that far apart in age. I mean, John Lennon was a year older than me anyway, you know, so, and Paul's about a year younger. So we're all in that ballpark of age, and every one of us, Buddy was one of those early rock and roll influences. And the thing was with the guitar, Neil, it just looked so amazing. the Stratocaster. You know, it was such a different look. It looked like it came from Mars or something. And that was quite an amazing thing. So when I got the first Strat, the red one with the gold-plated hardware, bird's-eye maple neck, whammy bar, when it arrived at the flat that Cliff, Bruce, and I used to share together, it arrived, and, you know, we opened up all the packing materials, and there was the tweed Fender case there. And we just looked at this thing. Yes, we have to open it. And I opened it up, and the inside is lined with like a red sort of velvety stuff inside. And this guitar was just, and it just looked so absolutely wonderful. And it was indeed a wonderful instrument. And, you know, I'm so glad that I went for the Stratocaster, because with that whammy bar on there, or as Fender call it, tremolo
yes.
arm, it's actually a vibrato bar, of course, is that, because of the heavy strings we all had at that point, that enabled me to do things that you couldn't do with your left-hand fingers alone. I mean, the strings were so heavy, the only string I could bend was the second string up about a half tone. But with that whammy bar, I can pull it up another half tone and do a full tone bend. I could also give up a vibrato, you know, just by hitting a note and then just gently shaking the arm to give a... And that was one thing with guitars that I used to always find annoying. On classical guitars, you hear the guys put a vibrato on there, because on nylon strings and gut strings, it's quite easy to do a classical finger vibrato where they just roll the finger vertically in line with the string. And you can't do that very easily on steel strings. It doesn't respond so well.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sax players with vocalists, most of them have a vibrato. And I felt it was much more expressive and appealing if you could achieve that. And now with this whammy bar, I found I could do that. I could pull strings up. I could waggle it and make weird noises. I could dip strings like you might do with a voice dipping off a note, you know.
Yes.
So it enabled me to develop a technique which became a style, and that coupled with my Echo Box and the Vox amplifier and the sound, the combination of those things produced the sound that fortunately people liked. So I'm so glad I got that Fender and not perhaps a Gibson or something, because I would never have developed my style if it hadn't been for the Fender.
In some ways, it was the most innovative guitar that came along since the days, perhaps, of Les Paul and
yeah.
the way that he recorded, yes.
In many ways, the fact that the shape, of course, the double cutaway, enabling you to get right up the neck, the machine heads all on one side of the headstock rather than three one side, three the other, to keep the strings in a straight line, the floating bridge with individual adjusting saddles so you could adjust the intonation of each string individually, which on most guitars you couldn't then, which enabled you to get the guitar much more in tune up the neck, you know, the intonation of the instrument. Sure, as you say, so much in the way of innovation on that instrument. It's interesting, just getting back to the finger vibratos, it's interesting that Django Reinhardt, whose music we will be interpreting, his and Stefan Grappelli's music when we do this little tour of New Zealand, Django had the most remarkable finger vibrato. He used to do a horizontal one, side to side, in other words, which is like the blues players do now and modern guitarists. But he was the first one that I'm aware of who did that and had such an incredible vibrato. He used to, you know, he used to bend the strings. He'd use octaves and an outrageous sort of chord stabs like a big band. He was a monster player, absolute monster player, and a lot of his techniques have been incorporated by later players in the world of jazz and in rock and blues too.
Hank, you were able really to express yourself in many ways once you went alone, once you got solo, and I'm thinking, and I'm not just saying this because I'm talking to you, but one of my favorite instrumentals for years and years and years has been Sasha. I just love that tune. It is just magic. What was the background to the name and recording that?
Well, until it happened, Jerry Lorden, who'd written several hits for the Shadows and the Yoda, like Patchy Wonderful Land, Atlantis, Mustang, he was writing some songs with Roger Cook. Roger Cook and Roger Greenaway were that time top British songwriters, and they were writing, and they started to write the song for a very popular French singer. And as we were writing the material, they looked at each other and said, this would make a great instrumental. I wonder if Hank would be interested in. So they brought me the instrumental. They did a demo, brought it, and I thought it was great, recorded it. And, you know, it's always been a favorite of mine too, Neil, by the way. And they didn't have a title, so they decided to call it Sasha, after Sasha Distel. But, yeah, it is a cracking tune, Neil. I agree with you. Cracking tune. I used to love doing that on stage with my band. Used to love it. What I used to do is play the verses on an acoustic guitar on a daisy stand, and then when it comes to the chorus, which is on electric, I'd just step away from it. I had my guitar hanging on the back, just swing it around, play the chorus, swing it back around, back onto the acoustic for the third verse.
The other instrumental that I've always loved and enjoyed, it's not one of yours, but I'm sure you've heard Classical Gas by Mason Williams. That's a lovely tune.
Oh, great. I've got to tell you a funny story about that. On a Shadows tour, I think we did it on an album called String of Hits, and I had to do it on stage. And we get to, there's a spot on the number where it sort of goes down, 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 and then it's dun, 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 big stabs. Then yes. there's a break. Then the horns come in. Bam, bam, ba, 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 ba. So we get up to that spot, hit the break, and nothing happened. And I look around at our keyboard player, who is then Cliff Hall, who had all the sounds on the keyboards for the horns and everything. And he's just looking at me, smiling. I looked at him. He smiled back at me. And there's nothing going on. Then suddenly he realized he should be playing. And there's a look of horror on his face. And then suddenly we heard, ba, 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 ba. And of course the audience were totally baffled.
Look, the exciting thing about Hank Marvin is that you're living in Perth, in downtown Perth,
yep,
these days. You're not far away from the recording studios. In fact, where we're talking right now, you at Niveram, is that the name,
yep,
you called it? Which
that's
is
right,
one,
yes,
of your tunes. That's Marvin spelt backwards. In fact, your name, the Hank, came from Marvin Rainwater, didn't it? Way back, or an influence.
The Marvin, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. In the days when everyone wanted to change their name to make it sound more funky or rocky or whatever it might be, you know, as with actors and everyone. And yet Marvin Rainwater was a country western singer, part Cherokee Indian.
Yeah.
And he had a huge number one hit in the UK called A Whole Lot of Woman. And so I decided to adopt that as my surname. And then I changed it by deed when I was 18. So that became my official name anyway.
That's from Brian Rankin. Your birth name, yes.
Yeah, right.
So you live in Perth, and that's where you've been for a number of years now. And you, as I said, you're involved in the recording studios, and that means that you're never far away from perhaps putting down a track or two when you want to. What do you record these days? There's not enough of it gets out here, Hank.
I don't do much in the way of recording. The last big thing I did was our Gypsy Jazz album, which was most of the music on that album were Django Reinhardt and Stephen Grappelli compositions, with a few standards like I Can't Give You Anything for Love and After You've Gone. What we like to do is take those numbers and give it our own treatment. It's still in the gypsy jazz or gypsy swing genre, but we like to inject something fresh into it. So that was the last big thing I did here, good, apart from the track for Brian Bennett just a few weeks ago for an album he's making. He wanted me to play on a track, so I felt sorry for him, so I said yes.
But anyway, Hank, bring a container load of those CDs with you when you come, because people will be queuing up to buy them. In fact, I think your tour later this year in New Zealand will be a sellout. We're so thrilled that you're coming, really thrilled. Gypsy Jazz, that is the title you give, is it, to the show, and it's yourself and two other performers?
Three. There's Nunzio Mondia, who is a local guy here. He's a magnificent musician. I've used him quite often on my solo albums on various keyboards. Classically trained pianist, but a magnificent accordion player. And on guitar is Gary Taylor. Gary Taylor is also resident of Perth, from the UK originally. He is, has also played on quite a number of my albums on rhythm guitar and bass guitar. He was in a band called The Herd, Neil, back in the late 60s,
oh, yes,
with Peter,
yes,
Frampton.
Yes.
Yeah, and then he became a session musician in the UK in the 70s, and also had his own radio show on BBC. And then he emigrated to Perth because most of his family were living here. It's basically us three plus a bass player, and the bass player we'll be using is a very fine player from Perth called Robbie Pisano. He is, that's Pisano. He is a fine player, but also he teaches bass at various institutions and so forth, schools and whatever.
And are you a happy man these days? Are you content with life? Everything okay?
Yeah, I can't complain at all. I've had a very long and successful marriage, to which all of which I owe to my wife. No, seriously. My two youngest kids have just, my son moved back from the UK, youngest son Ben, who's a really great guitarist. He just finished his Bachelor of Music course in the UK. He moved back last September. My youngest daughter, Talia, moved back from Germany with a husband. And she's back here now. In fact, I went to see their first gig last night. They're working as an acoustic duo, and they got their first gig last night. It was really good. I was very proud of them.
Great.
They did a fantastic job. She's a pretty good singer, Talia. She's never worked solely as a professional singer. She's been like a marketing analyst and all kind of things. But she happens to be very talented, and she's always loved to sing. And so they're trying to make just get this little acoustic gig thing going. But
that's
last night was really terrific.
Oh,
yeah.
That's great.
Really enjoyed it.
And Hank, can you stroll down the street in Perth? You must be known, and people know you live in Perth, but do the locals come and chat to you?
Are you one
of those people that can...
The thing is, well, obviously the worst place for me is the UK, because I've done a lot of TV in the UK over the years, very little in Australia. But yes, people still recognize me, but not all the time. I mean, the funniest thing is when people say, yeah, has anyone ever told you you look just like Hank Marvin? And I say, yes, enough they have. And if they don't pursue it, I leave it at that. It's only if they go from and say, but are you?
Oh, that's great. Well, look, you sound on top of the world, and that's fantastic. And as I said at the start, it's really exciting to catch up with you. You have been so influential in the choice of music for so many people in this country, as well as around the world, as I've said, because you are a supreme performer, a guitarist of total class, and it's just,
thank you.
It's just something to be able to say hi to you and thank you and congratulate you on your fantastic career, and tell you how much we're really looking forward to seeing you in this part of the country towards the end of the year. In October, you're playing here at the Glenroy. In fact, as I said at the start, you will sell out. This will be a sellout, and I wouldn't be surprised to see you doing extra dates.
Well, we hope so, Neil. We're really looking forward to going over there. And we found playing this music, this gypsy swing, that a lot of people who come to see us, they don't know what to expect. But jazz people do. You know, they know all about Django Reinhardt and Stephan Grappelli, so they know what to expect. But finding a lot of Shadows fans come along just out of curiosity, and they all think it's wonderful. And
yes,
I think the reason for that is it's a very happy music. It's the good tunes. We structure it well. We've got really good arrangements. We inject humor into our music. And it's very easily accessible from an audience point of view. It's not like a jam session or anything like that, you know, where people are just playing for interminable solos. It's not like that. It's, I think people, as I say, people always seem extremely pleasantly surprised when they hear it. They say, oh, this is fantastic. Never heard this sort of music before. Brilliant. So that's what we hope that people will feel like when they see the show.
They will.
And it's in a way, it's a kind of an evening with as well, because I get the opportunity to talk to the audience and have a bit of fun with them and things like that, which is nice, and it, you know, brings us closer together, so to speak. So that'll be good too. But anyway, look, thanks for those very kind words, Neil. I appreciate that. And my head's just grown in stature for the next few minutes, but I'm going to get back to rehearsal anyway. We hope to see you over in New Zealand then.
I can't wait. Thank you, Hank Marvin.